Thank you, Mr. Marker. It's good to see all of you again, and don't you love this time of year? Do you feel it in the air? It's just got that fall-like feeling, and the windows you kind of can start opening again, and it's got that feast vibe. So it's just, I don't know about you, I love that this time of year is just, I wake up. Not that I'm sleeping the rest of the year, but particularly kind of wake up this time of year. So looking forward to it, and especially with the fall holy days. I know we're all excited about the meaning of these days. We had a saying at our house when I was a kid. You had sayings at your house. I'm sure you all grew up. You had some things you kind of said as kids and in your families. But we had one in our house among many. When we knew we were going to go get a treat, and specifically if we were going to go get ice cream, my sister and I would be in the back seat kind of bouncing around in our seatbelts. We wore them back then. So that wasn't that long ago. But we'd invariably be chanting this little jingle with great glee. And I'm not sure where it came from or if anyone else said it, but it was big in my family. And it was, "You scream, I scream, we all scream for ice cream." Okay, so you know it. All right, it wasn't just my family. It's a catchy tune, it's a catchy jingle. We thought so anyway. And I hadn't really thought about that little jingle for a lot of years. But a few weeks ago, it came to my mind. I had decided on a particular day a month or so ago, I was going to make my way to the small town of Afton, which isn't too far from here. It's about 10 miles from my house. And Afton sits at the edge, if you don't know it, it's the edge of the St. Croix River Valley. On its west side and on its south side, there rise out of it two formidable hills. And one of those hills, the one that rises for about 2 miles on the south side, is a favorite training spot for cyclists, who like to take that ride and use it to work out. It was also a favorite training route for someone that I know many of us here, you all knew and loved, Pete McNair. And that hill we affectionately called to as Pete's Hill. That was what we kind of referred to it as. And so we ride that, and that was the hill that I intended to ride that afternoon in Afton. Now, I, like many people, had put a little bit of weight on working from home during the pandemic, and I was determined that I was going to try to get it off that summer, or this summer, and so I decided I had to up my game a little bit. And so riding Pete's Hill seemed like a great place to get that done. On the downside, or the upside, depending on your perspective, is that in the small town of Afton, it's also home to the place called Selma's Ice Cream. I don't know if any of you have been there, but it has literally the most amazing, in my view, and the best tasting large assortment of ice cream flavors you could ever experience in the modern world. And I don't think that's hyperbole. It was amazing stuff. And so if I wasn't careful, Selma's would definitely thwart any plans I had of getting rid of that unwanted pounds. But I had a plan, you see. I had a plan. I never go into this kind of situation without a plan. My plan was that if I worked hard enough, if I burned enough calories riding that hill, I could reward myself with one super small scoop of that luscious creaminess at the end of my ride. Really, really small. And I mean, how many calories could that be? Certainly fewer than I would burn mashing the pedals of my bicycle up Pete's Hill, or so I hoped. And so armed with that, what I thought was pretty sound logic, I set out to pedal up that hill. And that's when that phrase I mentioned at the beginning popped into my mind. It started playing in my head, anticipating that reward I'd have at the end of that ride. "You scream, I scream, we all scream for ice cream." Well, my jubilant attitude quickly went the direction I was cycling, south. And my original plan that I'd set out on this ascent was for sure to do one trip up that hill. I'd done it before. I was so confident that I could do it again, even though I had gained a few pounds. Okay, a few more pounds, 10 to 15, but who's counting? But I had never set up on that hill to do repeats on it. It had always been kind of part of a longer ride, like a 20-mile ride, a 30-mile ride. And this time, though, I was going to go up to the top and do at least one cycle up to the top and then stop at the top, turn around, and come back down. I'd seen other cyclists do it. It was a thing, and I wanted to do at least two. That was my goal. If I could do two, I'd feel really good about it, the day. So I figured that it would be pretty good for my first time because getting up that hill had always been challenging. So two, I thought, was a pretty good challenge to set for myself. Well, my body and my brain quickly began to fall into rebellion against that plan about halfway up my climb. My legs began screaming. My blood was throbbing in my head. And I began to think, yeah, Tony, maybe one. Maybe one's enough. Maybe that's good enough. The hill's not going anywhere. You can come back another day. But while that thought was percolating in my head, another cyclist, I didn't even know he was there, he came up beside me, and I noticed he was, as I looked at him to the side of me, he was about my age, but much, much fitter than I was. Much, much, he just looked like he belonged on that bike, unlike I felt at that moment. And so he came up alongside me, and he looks over at me, and I kind of look at him shocked, and he goes, "Tough slog, isn't it?" And I went, "Yeah." And then I just didn't know what to say, and then I watched him slowly ride ahead of me up the hill. Now, there's something mentally that happens when you're passed by another cyclist. And I know there's people here that get exactly what I'm talking about. Maybe this happens to runners as well, but it kind of sends a jolt through you. And it did for me, a little burst of adrenaline. And suddenly I felt a little more pep in my pedal stroke. Not enough that anybody watching me would notice it, but it was enough that, just enough of an extra little burst of energy for me to make a small mental shift from, I'm dying, I gotta stop, to, maybe I can do this. And so, and it was enough. Now, as I continued up that hill, that other rider, he was still in my view. I could see him kind of disappearing. I noticed as he reached the top of that hill and he crossed the road and he turned around to face downhill. He stopped for a drink of water and he was wringing the sweat out of his headband. And so I reached the top and he was still there. And so I just thought, I'm going to pull up alongside of him and try to catch my breath, which took me a little longer than I figured it would. But once I did, I said, breathlessly, "Hey, nice day for a ride. How many repeats are you doing?" And he replied, "Oh, hey, yeah, this is number 8 for me. And I'm hoping to do 2 more and finish up the day with 10. I don't know if he noticed my jaw dropped to my handlebars, but all I could say was, "Awesome, good luck." And I just kind of left and rode down the hill, contemplating what I had just heard. But on the way riding down the car, as I was thinking, I'm wiped out. I'm going to put my bike in the car. I'm going to go maybe get some Selma's now, maybe a really little scoop. Only did one after all. I began to think, wait a minute. How can I not try one more? He can do 10. What's wrong with me? I got to try, right? I mean, I can't just stop. So I got to the bottom of the hill. I turned around. I took a long drink of water, and I did. I began that long, steady ride upward again. Repeat number 2. Here we go. Well, I passed that cyclist, the guy. He came back down the hill in that time, and he cycled. And by the time I was about a quarter of the way up the hill, he passed me again for his 9th ascent. And when I was about 2/3 up the hill, having lost all sensation in my legs by that point, he had reached the top and began making his way back down. And he passed me on the other side. And as he passed me, he looked over to me and he yelled something I couldn't really understand, but I took it to mean, shaking his head, "I don't know." And I took that to mean, hearing that, I became alarmed for some reason. A lightning bolt again went through me. For some reason, and I don't know why for sure, it mattered to me that he get 10 in. He couldn't quit now. And so I had the sense even that he had yelled over to me as a plea, maybe, for encouragement. And so I did. I don't know how I yelled because I could hardly breathe, but I yelled over to him, "You got this, man. Just one more. You're inspiring me." And now, it didn't occur to me until I'd finally reached the top of the hill kind of how stupid that comment was, because I realized, how could I yell that encouragement for him to do one more and then me turn around and go back to my car and pack up my bike and drive away and not be there for him? Well, I had to see it through. I felt some kind of strange camaraderie with this guy I'd never met, like we were brothers in arms fighting in the trenches. We had each other's back. We were conquering rather the same obstacle, our same limits together. We hadn't shared more than two sentences, but somehow I felt he expected me to get up that last hill with him. Maybe not with him, but somewhere there on that hill. And suddenly I expected that of myself as well. I didn't want to let him down. In that moment, I realized I had no choice but to do the right thing, and so I was locked in to doing not two, which was my original goal, but three hill repeats, even if it killed me, which at this point I felt like it very might well do so. All right, well, we'll pause there. We'll come back at the end, and I'll tell you how that story turned out. Turn, if you would, over to Hebrews 12. Hebrews 12. Why am I sharing you this long story? Well, that experience climbing that hill that day with that other cyclist triggered some thoughts of another hill that I'm climbing, and one that we all climb. We all climb together. For those of you who like messages with points, this isn't going to be one of those, so I apologize. I don't have 7 points for conquering your spiritual mountains or anything like that. I really just want to share some thoughts that have been bouncing around in my head since that day climbing Pete's Hill. And thoughts about climbing this spiritual hill that we all climb. Nothing revolutionary, nothing we don't already know, but some things I believe are worthwhile for you and I to be reminded of. And I know that was true for me, and perhaps it will be for you as well. Because we are really in training, aren't we? We know that. We're in training. The struggles of this life are to be preparing us, getting us in shape for a future that lies ahead. And it is a bit of a slog. It is a bit of a climb for us, isn't it? Our God, though, has put us here on this climb together to struggle through, to endure this climb for a reason. And that reason has a lot to do with that story I just shared. Here in Hebrews 12, after recounting the names and actions of great heroes of the faith that have preceded us in Hebrews 11, examples of men like Abel, Abraham, women such as Sarah, Rahab, and others, Paul writes, beginning here in verse 1, Hebrews 12, verse 1, and I'm reading from the ESV. "Therefore, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us also lay aside every weight and the sin which clings to us so closely. And let us run with endurance the race that is set before us, looking to Jesus, the founder and the perfecter of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and is seated at the right hand of the throne of God." Now, obviously, we know our greatest example, the one we're told to here to look to, is Jesus Christ. That's a given. That's a given, right? But today I want to focus on those that we read of at the beginning of that passage. I want to focus on that great cloud of witnesses, because they have a critical role to play as well, as we're told here, in helping us to endure this hill, this climb, this race that we're in. And it says we're surrounded by this great cloud of witnesses. The Greek word translated cloud here is nephos, N-E-P-H-O-S, nephos, which can also be translated as throng or multitude. And so we have this multitude then of heroes of the faith inspiring and urging us on from the grave. And I don't know about you, but it's kind of hard for me to identify with them on one level. They seem in many ways larger than life, don't they? So much more, I don't know, spiritual. In some ways, it's tempting to see them the way maybe I in a very small way, the way I viewed that guy on the hill that passed me on the bike. He was on his way to 10 hill repeats while I was struggling with the idea of just making two. He seemed kind of superhuman to me in a way. These heroes of old, this cloud of witnesses Paul writes about here, they in some ways seem super spiritual. We're humbled and awed by them and by their examples. But the truth is, and we know this, we're all still joint heirs with them, aren't we? We run the same race they did. We all climb the same hill. One day we all hope to be with them. That's our hope. And our story will potentially one day be told right alongside theirs. And so there's a camaraderie that we can feel with them, and we should feel with them, isn't there? And we're told here that seeing that we have this cloud of witnesses, those witnesses should enable us, inspire us, to lay aside every weight and the sin that so readily clings to us. Now, a couple years ago, I may have not have struggled as much pedaling up that hill there in Afton as much as I did this time. I had packed on, as I said, a few pounds and since the beginning of the pandemic, and believe me, I felt it. I felt every one of them going up that hill. It just kind of weighed me down and pulled me back. But we have weight to carry that we carry in our personal spiritual lives, really, that does the same thing. That can weigh us down and hold us back. Baggage we might carry around, maybe, you know, from fear, our fears, maybe insecurities, past experiences that keep us from having the confidence we need to know and believe we can make it. And we have an enemy whose voice we sometimes hear in the back of our head saying, you can't make it, right? You're not good enough. You're not strong enough. You think you can make it to the top? No, you're not. You're going to give out. You're not worthy enough for God to finish what he started in you. And then in addition to those self-defeating thoughts, we have sin that so easily clings to us, as it says here in the ESV. So our inability to overcome some things as quickly as we'd like to, or old sins that we thought had overcome, they show up again and they kind of cling to us and weigh us down spiritually, making us question whether we can make it. Paul here is saying, hey, you know, you're not the only one. You've got some challenges to face, yes. You've got a slog ahead of you that you have to climb up. But you're not alone. You're not the first to overcome that hill, these challenges. You have a cloud of witnesses, a multitude, that if you read about them here, you know that they had their own baggage, right? You know they had their own struggles, their own sins to deal with. Their examples are laid down for us here to encourage us, to inspire us that it's doable. It's doable. So you can lay that stuff aside and you can keep running the race and keep climbing that hill. Turn back, if you would, a couple of chapters here in Hebrews to Hebrews chapter 10. Hebrews 10. Here in Hebrews 10, we read of another cloud of witnesses in addition to the ones that went before us so long ago. There's a multitude of fellow strugglers climbing this, keep that analogy going, the spiritual hill that we climb, this mountain that we've been called to climb with us. Not just back then, but here, now. A multitude, while their names are not yet written in this book, they have just as much potential to impact our ability to endure to the end as those heroes of old there in Hebrews 11 did. Here in Hebrews 10, verse 24, we read, Hebrews 10, verse 24, it says, and let us, that's us, right? That's you and I, consider one another in order to stir up love and good works, not forsaking the assembling of ourselves together, as is the manner of some, but exhorting one another, and so much the more as you see the day approaching. Now we often, and I know I often read this passage in the context of the importance of gathering together on the Sabbath, just being here physically, and the importance of not neglecting that. And certainly that's part of the intent. But Paul isn't just talking about skipping church, right? It includes that for sure, but it's more than that, because Paul writes here, he says, let us consider one another. The gist is really, you know, that we need to show up for one another. And certainly that includes gathering together physically, and but it also is about showing up for one another in other ways, right? To contribute to the spiritual lives of one another, but to show up in consideration of the impact that our presence might have on our brothers and sisters in Christ, on their spiritual well-being, because it's not just about us. It's not just about our getting fed or how I get encouraged because I had a tough week or what I need to receive spiritually on the Sabbath. We're to show up so that we might have an impact on others. And so that, as it says here, we might stir one another up to love and to good works so that we are able to exhort one another. Now, that word exhort, you know, maybe it's not the best translation here. It carries to me, in my mind anyway, the sound of correction. But in the Greek, it's the word parakaleo, P-A-R-A-K-A-L-E-O, that's translated exhort here, really carries another meaning, which gives it a little different sense, I think, than what Paul intended. Certainly, that Paul intended here. Certainly, you know, depending on the circumstances, exhortation might be warranted. But the word also can be translated as comfort, and to be comforted, to encourage, and to be encouraged, to strengthen, to be strengthened, to console, and to receive consolation. And now we might think, you know, yeah, console, stir people up, be an encourager. That's just not me. I mean, I'm not a stir people up kind of personality. That's, you know, I love people. I like serving them. I'm just not the nurturing, encouraging, strengthening, stir people up type, right? That's someone else's gift. I'm just trying to stay positive and get myself here to church. That's an accomplishment. I'm just trying to get up the hill once, for crying out loud. Well, here's the thing. Those things are not just active, are they? They're not just actions. They certainly can be, but they also are impressions that we give, that other people see from a distance, potentially. You know, that other cyclist on the hill that day, he didn't know he was showing up for me. He had no idea. He wasn't aware of his impact on my training session, but it was huge, more than just allowing me not to feel guilty about that scoop of ice cream at Selma's, right? He had an impact on me physically and emotionally and, yeah, even spiritually. But it was from a distance. He witnessed to me from a distance, not intending to, not realizing he was doing it, but it was a powerful witness. Well, we do the same for others just by showing up. Just by showing up. Back in the late 80s, I had the opportunity for several years as a college student to serve at the church's summer camp up north of us in Orr, Minnesota. And I was just a young college kid, kind of self-centered, kind of in my own world, immature. And I was there at camp. Yeah, I was there to work. I was there to teach. But if I was honest, I was mainly there to have fun and pass the summer away with my friends, hanging out and having a good time. I was baptized, so I was convicted about the way of life that I had chosen and the one I had chosen to serve, but I was young in the faith, immature, as I said, and really kind of oblivious to things that were going on around me and the impact of some of the things that I was doing there, the reason I was there at camp, you know, to serve these kids. I remember having a break sometime in the morning every day between classes. I taught at the photography class up the hill, and I'd make my way sometime between classes before lunch down the hill to the camp dining hall and then kind of sneak into the kitchen to try to find something to snack on. And there were usually some young high school kitchen staff there who were preparing lunch when I would make my way through, and I remember feeling a little embarrassed about being there, because technically that was against the rules. And if you knew Dr. Nelson, you don't do things that are against the rules. But I was there, and so I remember trying to kind of feel the waters out every day when I go in, joke around, crack some jokes, be friendly, smile, how you doing, how's your day going, be kind of corny, and trying to make sure no one was upset at me for coming in there to grab some snacks. But I was really had in my back of my mind, go get that snack you're looking for, hunt that down, and then get out. That was my goal. That was my motivation, which I did, and then left and didn't think much more about it. And I just repeated that day after day after day. It was a good gig. I was able to get away with it all summer, pretty much. Well, years later, after I graduated from college, I met a young lady at a feast site or something. I don't remember what. It was another congregation. I don't remember the exact event now. But she made a point after services to come up to me. And she said, you know, and I'm paraphrasing from memory. She says, I remember you at camp. And she said, I remember because I didn't really want to be there at camp that year. I didn't enjoy it. There were some things happening in her life. I don't remember what she told me was going on, if she gave details of that, but just that things weren't going well for her. But she said, you know what, I remember you. I remember you. I remember you coming in and laughing and joking and chatting and just being so positive, and it just really had an impact on me. It cheered me up, and it made me feel better about being there. And to be honest, just better in general. And you know what? Your example at camp and the example of others that were there played a large part in her decision to apply for Ambassador College and the reason she's still in the church. Now, I remember hearing that, thinking, wow, I'm glad I didn't screw that up, because I very easily could have. I was oblivious. I was a young, stupid kid trying to get my snacks selfishly so I can get away with it. Could have easily gone the other way. And I was just thankful that God worked through that situation despite me, right? Despite my selfish motives. Turn, if you would, over to Romans 15. Romans 15. I guess what I'm leading toward here is, it's an obvious point, I think, but it's an important one. One we read about here in Romans 15. And again, I want to read from the ESV version because I think it's I like the way it's put. Romans 15, verse 1 says, "We who are strong have an obligation to bear with the failings of the weak and not to please ourselves. Let each of us please his neighbor for his good, to build him up. For Christ did not please himself, but as it is written, the reproaches of those who reproached you fell on me." I think it's important. Let's break this passage down in the Greek, because I think you have to understand the weight of what Paul is really communicating here, specifically what he means when he's comparing the weak that he mentions here to the strong, the failings of the weak to the strong. There's really a broader meaning than what is implied by a simple reading of the text. You have to get into the original language. So let's break it down. The Greek word for strong here is dynatos, D-Y-N-A-T-O-S. And that can be translated as able or capable. The Greek word for obligation here is ophilo, which don't know if I'm pronouncing that right, but it's O-P-H-E-I-L-O. And it can be translated as out or owe or behoove or be bound to, indebted to, or a moral duty. The Greek word for bear is bastazo, which can be translated as to lift. Bastazo, B-A-S, for those who are taking notes, B-A-S-T-A-Z-O, translated as to lift or to sustain or to carry. And then the Greek word translated here in the ESV as failings is asthenema, A-S-T-H-E-N-E-M-A, which can also be translated as infirmities. And then finally, adynatos, A-D-Y-N-A-T-O-S, and that's the Greek word translated as weak here. So it's the opposite of dynatos, of strong. So it's the opposite meaning, in this case, unable or not capable. And so given all these, the Greek words that we just talked about, perhaps a better reading of Romans 15 here would be to, like this, we who are able have a moral duty to sustain and to lift up those whose infirmity or infirmities make them not capable or not able. It's a subtle difference, but it is a difference, isn't it? It's a bit of a difference. And to be unable or incapable of handling something due to an infirmity. And an infirmity could be anything, right? It could be a bad day, or it just got you down, an emotion or a physical disability or whatever it could be. It could be many things. And it doesn't have to necessarily point to a permanent condition, does it? Someone could be considered incapable of handling something in the moment, in the present circumstances, for a variety of reasons. They might be going through a trial, coping with grief of loss, and struggling in their faith for some reason. And that could describe any one of us at some point, couldn't it? This month it could be someone else, next month it might be you or me who's not capable. So we show up for one another. We're there for one another, certainly in person if we can, but also from a distance, right? Through our witness and through our example to one another. Their witness is there for us, sustaining us when we need it, and ours is there for them, and it needs to be there. And what we're told here, it's our duty. It's our obligation to sustain and lift up those whose infirmity or infirmities make them in the moment not capable, not able. We have a duty to them to be a witness. In Galatians 2:20, Paul says of himself, I won't ask you to turn there, but he says of himself, and it applies obviously to us, that we have been crucified with Christ. And it's no longer Christ, it's no longer we rather that live, but it's Christ that lives within us. 1 Corinthians 6:19 tells us that our lives are not our own, that we've been bought with a price. And therefore, we are to glorify God in our bodies and in our spirit, which are God's. Romans 12:1 tells us that we are to consider ourselves as living sacrifices. So this life that we've given, it's not ours to give back. That sacrifice that we give, it's living, right? It's continual. It's not something we can put on hold, can we? It's not something we can say, okay, I'm off the clock. Today I just need a break. I'm going to step back. Give me a minute. It's not something we have the luxury to do. Or okay, I'm ready. Lights, camera, action, turn on. Everybody can look at me now. We don't have that option. We're always on. Because eyes and ears are always on. And there's people counting on us getting up that hill because it's giving them the strength in that moment to get up that hill, and they need us in that moment to allow them to keep up with their struggle. We have to show up for one another. So the choice isn't whether we own our witness or not. That's not the choice we make because we own it. It's ours, right? The choice is whether we'll embrace it. It's whether we'll be intentional about it. Our God's placed us here together so that we might all endure to the top of that hill and to the end together. Together. And that's what our God has provided for us here. And that's what he wants for us, to be intentional about our witness to one another. In closing, turn, if you would, over to Hebrews 11. Hebrews 11, verse 13, we'll begin there. We read of what we read again of those great heroes that went before us. It says these in verse 13 of Hebrews 11, all died in faith, not having received the promises, but having seen them afar off, were assured of them, embraced them, and confessed that they were strangers and pilgrims on the earth. For those who say such things declare plainly that they seek a homeland, and truly, if they had all had called to mind that country from which they had come out, they would have had opportunity to return. But now they desire a better, that is a heavenly country. Therefore, God's not ashamed to call them, to be called their God, for he has prepared a city for them. Those who have went before us, and they're recorded in the pages of Scripture, they clearly saw the reward that came after this struggle, right, after this climb. And it, too, kept them moving forward, enduring to the top of the hill and to the end of their ride. And I'm so thankful for them, aren't you? I'm so thankful for their examples and recorded here in Scripture. And I'm looking forward to letting them know at the end of this thing, right, what an inspiration that they have been to so many who have followed after them. And that's part of the picture of the days we're about ready to enter, is looking forward to that time when we can thank them, we can be together with them, our fellow strugglers. But I'm also thankful for those heroes we've known personally, who've been here among us, who's recently, in recent memory, finished their climb, who await the resurrection that we're going to picture in just a few days from now. And I miss them dearly, and I know all of you miss them dearly as well. But we're so thankful for them, aren't we? For their example, their strength, their faith, and their courage. And I know you are, I am. I'm looking forward to thanking them. And I'd be remiss to say, though, that I'm also so thankful for everyone here that's here today, possibly watching on the webcast, and the power of the witness that you provided and you continue to provide to all of us through your struggle. You know, when I consider the impact of that witness, of your example, and speaking personally of me and my children who've grown up among you, who spend much time of their youth here watching, listening, learning, I'm so thankful for so many of you who have so obviously owned that responsibility and lived it intentionally. In my life and the life of others, you've shown it and continue to show up. You make us better. We make each other better. So thank you. All right, so let me end this by finishing up with that story that I told you at the beginning, and shockingly, maybe to your surprise, but certainly to mine, I did manage to make it up that third push up Pete's Hill. I got up there. I'll spare you the gory details. Just it wasn't pretty. As I coasted, though, back down into Afton, I thought about the impact that guy that I didn't even know had on me. I hoped maybe I'd catch him at the end and I'd be able to say, hey, you know, congratulations. That was awesome. That 10 repeats, that's great. And if I had a chance to say, you know, I just want to thank you. You helped me exceed my goal. I didn't think I could do it, and that was on you. But as I pulled up, there he was. He was in his car. He was pulling out of that same parking lot that I was pulling out of, and he looked over me, and we exchanged waves, and he was gone, and that was it. And he left oblivious to the impact his struggle had on me that afternoon. But you know, as I loaded up my bike, the spiritual application of what I had just experienced on that hill began to bounce around in my brain. And because honestly, I became so engrossed in those thoughts and kind of what that had awakened in me in terms of analogies and things, it became the genesis of this message, really, that I forgot all about that ice cream at Selma's until I was almost in my driveway back home, and I realized, oh, that creamy deliciousness is going to have to wait for another time. And then that jingle came to my head again. Ice cream, you scream, we all scream for ice cream. Well, next time. But that version was quickly replaced with another version that came to me, one which admittedly is a little cheesy, but one that nonetheless, in the context of that afternoon on Pete's Hill, carried quite a bit more meaning. And so it became the title of this message, and really the message I want to leave with you today. I endure, you endure, we all endure to the kingdom.